Thanks again. My name is Julie Samples. I'm also an attorney, and this is also my first APHA experience, so bear with me. I wanted to actually start by saying thanks to some people who are not here, and the names are listed there, but Nargis, Valentin, and Santiago all work for the Oregon Law Center. Stephanie is a university partner at the Portland State University School of Community Health. Farmworker Justice, PECUN, which is a farmworker union in Oregon, and Salud Medical Center are all project partners. And the focus of this presentation is on the promotores, and so I wanted to just give them a thanks since none of the promotores could come with me for this presentation. Just to give a little bit of background on indigenous farm workers, as you can see, there are millions of indigenous people in Mexico, 68 ethnic groups, each group speaking their own language. Languages have no resemblance to Spanish. Oftentimes when we talk with employers or state agencies, indigenous languages are referred to as dialects. Sometimes people think that they might be dialects of Spanish. That's not true. And many of the indigenous languages don't have a current common form of writing. And so simply translating a brochure into an indigenous language won't work. There are many books out there, and I think in a couple slides I'll show you how indigenous languages are being written. But this is not something that people learn in school and would be able to sort of read off the bat. I would also mention that within indigenous languages there are dialects. For example, Mixteco, which is a language spoken by about 70% of the indigenous farm workers in Oregon, has three main dialects, but you know, over 50 other dialects. Oops. And in Oregon, we have 174,000 migrant and seasonal farm workers and their family members. And berries, tree fruits, nurseries, vineyards, and Christmas trees are some of the things that they work on. Nurseries and Christmas trees being some of the larger industries, but field work is still very large industry in Oregon, particularly sort of all kinds of berries, strawberries, blueberries, et cetera. And an estimated 30 to 40% are workers from indigenous communities in Mexico. And there's a small number of indigenous farm workers from Guatemala. For people who might be from Washington, there are more indigenous Guatemalans working in Washington than in Oregon. And some of the most common languages among the farm workers in Oregon are Mixteco, Triqui, and Zapoteco. And here's the promise slide that shows some. One in the corner is, the top corner is Spanish. And then on the left, it's Quetzal, and then over to the right is Tzotzil, and I don't remember what the one is on the top. And as you can see, the language itself is blocked out. Quetzal and Tzotzil are both, they're indigenous languages spoken in Chiapas, Mexico. And it's written phonetically. So our project, Promoting the Occupational Health of Indigenous Workers, aims to develop community-based strategies to improve health and safety conditions and access to services for indigenous farm workers. As you can see, our grant has ended. We're now on a no-cost extension. Just briefly, I just want to go over the types of data that we gathered and how we did it, the methods. We did focus groups, and you can see the categories that those covered. We did 6 focus groups with farm workers. 2 were conducted in indigenous languages, 1 in Mixteco, 1 in Triqui. They were facilitated by indigenous community educators who are project partners, 2 people from the Oregon Law Center, 1 person from Salud Medical Center, and 1 person from PECUN, the union. And those were transcribed and translated from the ones in Mixteco. The folks in our office who speak Mixteco listened to those and transcribed those or translated them into Spanish, and then we had a professional person put them from Spanish into English. And for people who are interested, some of those results are published in the Journal of Immigrant and Minority Health last year. We also did surveys. We did a baseline survey in 2006 with 150 Latino and Indigenous farm workers. We split it evenly, 75 Latino, 75 Indigenous. And those were completed in Spanish and Mixteco and Triqui by the same project partners. And those results have just been published in the American Journal of Public Health. I didn't bring copies of these articles with me, but if you'd like to receive articles, I can send you PDFs if you come up afterwards and just send me your email. The survey included questions about demographics and language, if people had received pesticide training, if so, if was it effective, what did they learn, I had questions about working conditions, discrimination, language discrimination, health status and access to care, and how workers obtain information regarding health and social services, and how would they like to receive information about health and social services. The surveys were conducted at labor camps and other places such as laundromats, churches, et cetera. Some were done in some parks. And the workers identified priorities for workplace safety. We also do significant outreach to Indigenous communities. And so because so many people will not be able to understand written information in Spanish or, you know, in their own language, we do a lot of one-on-one conversations, but we also use audio materials. And so we have CDs and tapes, although we've, I think when we first started with the tapes in 2003, we had tapes and CDs. This past year, we did only CDs because nobody seems to have tape players anymore except for me. And so we've put, what we've done with the tapes, rather than just sort of recording information in Indigenous languages, we've created sociodramas. And so they're about 3-minute long skits regarding 10 issues that the community identified as what they wanted information about. So for example, pesticide safety. And so the skits are what you sort of would imagine, just you know, 3 or 4 voices acting out some sort of, you know, issue. And then in between each skit, there's music. And Valentin from the Oregon Law Center has been able to get music from each community or region. So for the tapes that are in Triqui, he plays tapes that are from, might be somebody playing music, a community member who speaks Triqui. To make it a little bit more exciting, and also people have commented how great it is for them to hear music from their own community on something like that. We also reinforce that through radio programming. Pekun has its own radio station. It's a community radio, sort of nonprofit station. We have an hour-long program every week called Haga Valer Sus Derechos, or Make Your Rights Worthwhile, essentially. And we also, through this project with Farmworker Justice, created what you see in the picture, which is a crop book. And this particular one looks at what pesticides are being used on strawberries in Oregon. And it provides information that the workers themselves requested, which is information on health effects. And you can't really see in that picture, but there are symbols or drawings of short-term effects, such as getting a rash. And so there's a picture of someone with a rash. And also long-term effects, perhaps leading to something like birth defects or something like that. And then finally, the use of a peer education or promotor program. And so the promotores disseminate occupational safety and health information. It's really focused on pesticide safety and so issues around pesticides. They also raise awareness of indigenous workers and their health needs, and it creates opportunities for local leadership. And throughout this, you've maybe noticed the pictures. These are pictures of the promotores. They know that their pictures were taken. They know that it's in this presentation, so you don't have to worry about that. Here's a picture of some of the promotores. And there were 10 promotores. They all speak an indigenous language, Mixteco Alto, Bajo, Triqui, from Copala, and Zapoteco from Ocotlan, that just refers to a city in Oaxaca. And they were trained to deliver information about pesticides, field sanitation, and farm worker rights to other farm workers. All the promotores are current farm workers. Some work in nurseries, some are field workers, and some do both, you know, nursery, field work, Christmas trees, et cetera. The training consisted of 4 days. And the curriculum utilized popular education techniques, and so there's lots of role-playing, skits, games, and small group discussions. You can see in the pictures, the one on the right is the promotores are actually working on a skit there. And the curriculum was designed by Farmworker Justice with input from the indigenous community educators on the project. We did two evaluations of the promotores themselves. One was the training and also the program. And so we used a pre and post training questionnaire. And I just wanted to you can read the quotes, but essentially the training was helpful for people to be able to then and go talk to their community members in their own languages about what they had learned and dangers that folks might face. We also did an evaluation of the program itself, and the promotores attributed their increased knowledge and skills to the training that they received. They really recognized the need to share information, and that their central duty was to share information with people who speak indigenous languages. And they talked about sort of the community knowledge of pesticides being very low, in particular the health effects of working in and around, or working with pesticides. One thing that the promotores asked was if they could meet with the director of our Oregon OSHA. And Oregon OSHA in Oregon is responsible for regulating labor camp housing, for example, but also field sanitation. And so for the first time in Oregon's history, as far as we know, the director met with the group of promotores. He came on a Sunday morning, which is when they asked if he could come, and he did. And they talked with the director about the gaps between their lives and the regulations. So just quickly, the promotores wanted to focus on three issues: washing machines, showers, and stove burners. And so they were focusing on lives in the labor camps. In Oregon, there are over 400 labor camps where farm workers are housed. And after the promotores met with the director, the rulemaking process was started to try to change some of the rules. And so public hearings were held after Oregon OSHA drafted some proposed changes. And then the promotores decided to testify. And instead of just sort of coming up and testifying, they actually came up with a skit to show how these things affected their lives. And so the previous rule said there's one shower for every 15 people. And they said, if you're telling me in your materials that I need to take a shower right away, how do I take a shower right away when I have to stand in line? Because there's one shower for 15 people. And so they said, so part of their skit was to show essentially that they have to stand in line for everything. So they have to stand in line for the shower, they have to stand in line to use the stove. And the prior law said as long as there was a washing machine within 5 miles of the camp itself didn't have to have one. So again, they said, look, your own materials tell me I need to wash my clothes, and not only do I need to wash my clothes, I need to wash my work clothes separately from my other clothes. And I've got, family laundry that I have to do too. So I have to go 5 miles down the road to wash my clothes. And they said, we need washing machines at the labor camp. And so the result was the new rules were issued, and the agency has now said that a machine or a tub must be provided on location, and that the promotores asked for one shower for every 5 people. The agency sort of split the difference and said one for every 10. And the promotores demanded 2 stove burners per family, and the agencies agreed to 2 burners for every 2 families. The previous law said have enough burners for the people that are there, so it's pretty vague. Some other activities included presenting with project partners at the EPA regarding worker protection standards. And some of the promotores reported stopping mayordomos, supervisors, from sending workers into recently sprayed fields. Another promotora was elected to serve on her safety committee at her workplace, a result of her participation in the program. The promotores was originally conceived to be a 3-month program so that they would spend June, July, and August, when the bulk of the work farm workers being done, you know, doing the peer education program. But I think after about 2 months, the promotori said, this 3 months is not long enough, we want to keep going. And so we have held monthly meetings with them since then. And this was started, the first training took place in 2007, in the spring of 2007. And so at the monthly meetings, at the promotori's request, we've provided training that they've asked for. So they've asked for training on minimum wage issues, sexual harassment, and some other issues. And so we have provided trainings at those meetings, but it's also a time for the promotores themselves to get together. And so one promotor stated that before the program, he felt isolated in the community. And now he feels he's not just working here, but he's involved with the community. And he talked about how he considered the other promotores to be like family. I have to tell you, I was at that meeting, and everybody was crying after he spoke. It was a very moving moment, and I think it just really reflects what these programs can mean, not only for the community, but for the people that are actually going out there and talking to other workers and who experience and see these things every day. So thanks.
So we have a little bit of time now for questions or discussions. Yeah, in the back. None of you experienced that, of course, in your projects. Someone want to answer?
Well, you specialize in asking difficult questions. That's good. Right at the outset, when we were conceptualizing how we would handle status as a variable in our study, we decided, together with the community partners, strong insistence that we just didn't collect the data. We don't ask in our project as to status. And I don't know if other projects do, or probably not. The one slide that I showed of the SHIP study, this one that's going to be looking at access to healthcare, this was a student driven survey, and they are going to ask status, and they are completing these surveys in the first pilot field work. So that sort of represents an experiment on at least from my frame of reference. But our desire was our conclusion was that if we asked status, it would have chilled response rates and participation.
Like David, we don't ask status either. And I have experience, you know, directly with farm worker projects, but I'll speak with the poultry. Yes, this is an issue, I think, across immigrant workers, because all these workers are told, well, if you don't work or if you don't like it here, there are four more at the door who will come in and do your job. But I think all of our projects have really tried to attack this issue at multiple levels. And that is by, we try to attack things at a community level, and that is making sure that when we have findings or when we have something going on, that we let non-immigrants in the community know about it. We were really helped this year because the Charlotte Observer put out a piece they had been working on for several years, and we had contributed by interviews with their investigative reporters and so on, that talked about what the conditions are in the poultry plants. And that got a lot of national attention, and certainly statewide attention. So that helped to sort of condition people to that. So I think, you know, as I said, you attack it at multiple levels. With farm workers, you attack it by going to the growers' associations. I think this idea that, you know, if I don't go in the fields, I don't get paid, certainly with farm workers, the other issue is if they don't, you know, if they get fired, there's nobody to harvest the tobacco. So it kind of works both ways. And I certainly understand the point of view of workers of saying I can't assert my rights, but they all kind of know the limits to which they can. And I think that's what we saw with workers in the poultry plants, was that they discovered that there was some solidarity, despite not having unions, that if enough of them knew they had their rights, instead of going one at a time to complain, they went in a group. And it worked, to a certain extent.
I mean, I think you raised the key point, which is if you just tell workers, well, you know, you have rights, just go in there and do it, it's not going to work. And that's why, you know, I think the success of these programs is showing the model of how you have to integrate all of these various elements and go beyond just individual worker education to building a support. So. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a challenge, and, you know, hopefully one of the lessons is showing that this is a good model, and therefore if you're looking for successful things to fund, you know, this is one way to go. But I think one of the things that this has done is to, you know, through these and many, many other projects, show examples of how safety and health becomes an important issue for communities and groups who are interested in working with immigrants. And so by having these projects as examples and hopefully generating materials which would be available to groups that, you know, the many immigrant organizations around the country who are looking to try and do things will actually have examples that they can turn to and, you know, not develop things quite the Cadillac version that some of these groups have been able to, but at least include safety and health as part of the core activities that they're doing. So I think from my perspective, that's one of the goals, because I think you raise a good point. You know, these are wonderful programs, but they exist because they have, you know, several hundred thousand dollars to be able to do it right. So I don't know if that's another question or response.
I have a question for the poultry processing plant program. I noticed that you used CCD in your materials. You chose to use the kind of scientific name of the illness. Why did you decide to use it, and how did that work? Because I really don't have.
Okay. That was very perceptive of you to pick that up. That was a deliberate decision made on our part. There were several kind of colloquial terms that people were using for this, and one of the problems was we wanted them to understand that they had a medically recognized injury. And that is why we use that term, that this was not something that was caused by putting their hands in cold water. It was not something that was caused by some of the other agents that they thought it was, that this was something that the U.S. medical community recognizes. It's caused by their repetitive motion in the job, and therefore it's legitimate to seek care for this. People could repeat what it was, and at least in our limited evaluation, they seem to recognize that, in fact, this was a condition related to their work.
Did you translate the
name? No, we did not. We called it CTD.
I'm just wondering, did you all have IRB approval from your university?
Absolutely, we did. You educate your IRB over a course of years.
Well, let me say this. At NIOSH, I have my own community-based participatory project with immigrants, and the first time it went to the IRB, the community representative on the IRB, so the only non-scientific person, sort of axed the whole thing and said, you can't, well, we had to fight it, but he said, you can't do studies with immigrants if you know they're undocumented, because by including them in studies, you might make, I mean, he was almost implying that NIOSH should not do research, should exclude immigrants from their research. And so we then, you know, the head of our IB actually convened a little panel and had our the top lawyer for NIOSH talk about what were the rights and what, so it's a long process, and you know, often the initial response is really ridiculous. Yeah. So.
I just have an additional comment. Yeah. The process is long and demanding, but two things are worthy of comment from our project is that the community members have become IRB experts. Don't we need a modification to ask that question? And we go, yes, we do. And in fact, the teen educators have been quite adept at looking over a survey and figuring out what's wrong with it. The final point is there is this feature, I don't know if it extends to all IRBs, but it's called independent investigator status. And essentially what we've done with our community partners is to have them go through the full IRB certification so that within the terms of our grant, not extending to other things that they might want to study, but within the terms of our grant, they can supervise work that's ongoing in terms of data collection and protection of confidentiality. They operate under the blanket approval of the university's IRB as community partners. Independent investigator status.
Do the teens do that too? Are they independent?
No. But they're supervised by independent investigators.
First, I want to say this is like amazingly impressive work, because I think it's some of the most hardest work to do. These are populations that, I'm from California, you know, we have many, many of the same kind of working populations that we have here. They're off the radar screen, they're undercounted, uncounted, very, very difficult to reach. So I want to say, first of all, it's just amazing to see guys have done. But I guess because I've had some personal experience working with community clinics and kind of seeing more of the third leg of that schooling of the partnership with the community health providers, whether any of you have had or what has been your experience, let's say you've done a health screening. I saw a photo, you know, where there was a health screening done, I guess it was in Somerville. If you found somebody with hypertension, let's say, or they needed a flu vaccine or some follow-up, you needed to refer them to a health center, and you needed to partner with a local healthcare provider. I saw one of the poultry photos had kind of a smiling doctor in one of the photos, and the doctors can be really
Yeah, I'll tell you more on November 16th. We're having a very large health fair sponsored by Cambridge Health Alliance to reach out to immigrant workers. One of the ways that we hope to handle the referrals just from a purely financial arrangement is we have money allocated in our grant to be able to pay for referral services that cannot be met through workers' comp or through some other funding vehicle. So I think we have the finances worked out. We also have relationships with the health clinic. So I hopefully it's you know, in terms of explaining the intent of our work, as well as we've interviewed their medical directors as part of the key informant interviews. And so to that extent, I'm hoping that it's going to work okay in terms of that transfer of being seen in a screening setting and then working into a care setting.
Yeah, I mean, one point is we've recently with NIEHS been kind of evaluating the program overall. And I think it's one of the things that we found is that the weakest part of the three-legged stool has been the community health clinics. And although projects have tried to do it and there's been some element, it's by far the weakest. And there's very few programs where I would say that's emerged as kind of a highlight that they've really integrated well with community clinics. I don't know.
In the project with Indigenous farm workers, Salud Medical Center was the community health clinic partner, and through the grant was able to hire a patient advocate who speaks Mixteco. And so we were able to refer Mixteco speakers to that clinic, and she was available for interpretation, but she also did a lot of patient home visits and things like if someone had diabetes and needed to buy particular foods, then she would go with them to the grocery store to show them what foods to buy, since the grocery stores could be sort of daunting to somebody who doesn't speak English or Spanish.
So I think we've gone over time. So maybe if people have other questions, they can, if the panelists can stay around for a few minutes and we can answer them. Thanks, everyone.